second half of our talk.
I'd like to pick things up now on the very interesting and broad area of copyright law, complement our earlier talk. Copyright law is a very interesting field. It covers such a vast array of areas in the U.S. economy, even internationally. And we'll talk tonight, Jeff, at a very high level about some of the copyright principles, and then talk about some applications of copyright law, some recent cases, which I'm sure many of you have heard about in terms of the Napster dispute, the Grobster dispute. Okay, so what is a copyright? Is it, one might ask themselves, what is a copyright, and perhaps more importantly, how does it differ from a patent? Now, we talked at the very beginning about a patent, and I want to be sure that that's very clear. Patent protection provides protection on four very specific classes of inventions, and those are machines, processes, manufacturers, and compositions of matter, and improvements to any of those four categories. Again, that's machines, processes, manufacturers, and compositions of matter. That's it for patents. It's a vast field, but it's really limited in the sense that it provides protection only for those four categories of inventions. Whereas a copyright protects the expression of an idea. And there may be many different and original expressions of the same idea. And expressions, since they are in essence not utilitarian, don't qualify for patent protection. They do, however, qualify for copyright protection. And the you might think of a copyright assembly as any original work of authorship expressed in a tangible medium, any original work of authorship in a tangible medium of expression. And that tangible medium can, in fact, be software code. It can be executing code, such as a multimedia or audiovisual product. But more classically, it is known as if a copyright arises in things like a book, an art, music, sound recording. So the rights that are conveyed with a copyright, the mere act of creation is sufficient to give rise to the creation of a copyright interest, and the legal test for getting a federal copyright registration really is whether it's an original work. So as long as you've got some original expression of an idea, perhaps, you know, each of us has the same idea, but we have in our own original expressions, we each will qualify for copyright protection. So it's not really about the implementation of the idea per se, just its expression. And there are five distinct rights that are granted under the copyright law to copyright holders. And that is the right to prepare derivative work, the right to reproduce the work, the right to distribute the work, the right to publicly perform the work, and the right to publicly display that work. Now for those five bundles of rights, that's saying quite a lot actually, and because that goes into every conceivable dimension that you can think of, be it literary and computer code. Written computer code has been deemed to be a literary work. So that's why I find it curious, at least, that software developers often talk of their works as publications. They have published software in a sense. They're using the vernacular of the literary world, and they're entitled to it. I mean, justifiably so, the copyright law views it as a written work, even though it is functional. Now, in software in particular, because both copyright laws and patent laws can be applied, that there is an important distinction that you must understand. Copyright on software refers to the actual expression of the code or the representation of its audio-visual execution. But the process, the automated processes that are executing within that code may also qualify for patent protection. And the patent law cases interpreting patent law now enable an executing software program to be construed as a machine, a software implemented machine. So it qualifies as one of those four categories of patent protection I mentioned: a machine, a process, a manufacturer, a composition of matter. So patent protection on the software implemented machine, patent protection on software executed processes, copyright protection on the expression of the code, and copyright protection on the audiovisual representation of that code. So there's a whole bundle of interesting rights that are available, and they all, with respect to the copyright interest, all of those qualify for those five bundles of rights I talked about earlier. So given the rights, if there's a violation of one or more of their rights, we call that an infringement of a copyright, of one or more of the rights of that copyright owner. And infringement has some very stiff penalties and under the copyright law. We'll talk about that a little later on. And for the infringement, there are a variety of different remedies that can be used to completely squash the unauthorized use of one's copyright protected work. And we've seen the consequences of copyright infringement, at least in the very famous Napster case, and the many millions of dollars of that involved as well. So don't think of copyright as some stepchild of patent law. I mean, there are some very powerful rights and remedies available to copyright owners. But there are certain statutory exceptions that are not actionable as infringement. One of the underlying public policies behind the copyright law is to encourage artists and authors to publish, to allow their works to get out into the mainstream, and for all of us to engage in what is central to the First Amendment, the free expression of ideas. We need to have a lively discourse of ideas back and forth, and part of what's called the fair use exception is intended to be a carve-out of the copyright law to allow works to be used in certain limited ways to enable their use to facilitate things that might be of an educational nature or academic or for research purposes. But once you cross the line from purely academic or scholarly exchange, once that becomes more of a monetary or commercial nature, then you start slipping into the world of some serious copyright infringement problems.
Is this meeting here tonight an educational or academic endeavor?
This meeting tonight is a business development. We know it.
Wait a minute, where's your needle?
Yes, I need video. Right. So this meeting is intended to be taken, however you like it, principally as informational.
No, I'm just asking that conceptually, if you have some copyrighted material that you were showing us, would this be an educational or academic use of such things?
Or fair use, is that the idea?
Yeah.
Fair use question.
Can you put the recording of the meeting on the website?
In the presentation is what I'm talking about here.
So if we put two pictures that are under copyright by some author next to each other to disseminate the fact that this is different from that.
Yeah.
Certainly we're within the realm of fair use because it's educational.
And it's free.
We'll get into the specific details of fair use a little later on, so you'll see exactly where the demarcations are. But you don't really want to be in that bucket, really. That's a thicket that you simply don't want to have to deal with, and we can regulate use in some very convenient ways through agreements, through contracts that enable and that explicitly authorize certain forms of uses. So, as I mentioned, a copyright is any original work of expression, work of authorship fixed in a tangible medium of expression. And that tangible medium can be simply putting code down on CD-ROM. It's fixed. Now, the term copyright protection depends on the nature of the author and the circumstances of its creation. and a work created by an individual author gives rise to a copyright that runs for the duration of that author's life plus 70 years.
That used to be 50?
Used to be 50, and I'll tell you why it got bumped up 20 years in a minute. Do you know what?
Wasn't there like something called the... Well, anyway, wasn't there some bump up from that to 100 recently?
I don't know if it's up to 100, but it bumped up from 50 to 70.
They're trying to
adjust the factor of that. But if the work is what's called a work made for hire, that is, there's an agreement, an arrangement, where some party is commissioning someone else to produce the work, then the term of copyright protection extends for 95 years from the date of its first publication, or 120 years from the date of creation, whichever expires first. And that arises in this very interesting relationship called a work made for hire. And there are certain very specific situations called out in this copyright law that enable that kind of relationship to be created. In the absence of that kind of relationship, as lawyers, we typically try to construe it as a work made for hire relationship in contracts between parties. And where that is not possible because the subject matter doesn't fit into that category, then we attempt to take an outright assignment or transfer of the copyright, which the author would otherwise have. We require that they assign it to the commissioning party via the contract. And then the commissioning party would then have the right to pursue a federal copyright registration on it to secure its interest. Rick?
Would a musician working for a publishing house, say like what happened at Motown or the Brill Building in New York, whose existence was to go there and write music, create songs, would that be considered a work for hire?
Music, no, not necessarily. Actually, in that particular instance, no. I think in those kinds of arrangements, those contracts are worded in such a way that there's an outright assignment. In order to get into one of those kinds of companies, there has to be an outright assignment of the work. A typical work made for hire arrangement arises where you've got someone who's engaged to, say, contribute to a compilation or a collective work, or translation, or a contribution to a text. And those are very specific areas called out in the law that allow for a relationship to be deemed a work made for hire arrangement.
I have a question.
Yeah?
Some groups of people are trying to use copyright law in a different way. Mm-hmm. Like the Richard Stallman and the Free Software Foundation.
Yeah.
Is using the copyright law to give limited licenses for their software to the developers. And in that case, you can have many people contributing to a project, and there's no corporation involved. Mm-hmm. There's many authors that are contributing, mm-hmm. and then the license on the software leverages copyright law. But I'm not sure exactly how long that's going to be attached to the software, because it's not clear which of the
GNU, the GNU,
yeah,
movement, the copy left.
The copy left, yeah.
Yeah. I've met Richard Stallman. He's an interesting character. He lives in the lab of computer science at MIT. He literally lives there and has a room. and their philosophy, it's an interesting one. It certainly is an interesting one because they want to get away from the property notion of copyright that's behind the law, in the public policy of it. In essence, they promote this notion of software for the masses because creativity comes best if people have access to works without paying a penalty, without paying a commercial fee for its use. And I think they've struck sort of a middle ground that, they have to acknowledge the existence of contracts despite the existence of copyright law, and they have to allow, well, they, I believe that the way they operate is to inform everyone who's making a contribution of the software work that, hey, you're waiving certain rights that might otherwise be available under the copyright law in exchange for granting, in exchange for getting access to this whole new opportunity for distributing software. But you also agree to grant certain kinds of rights for subsequent distribution and modifications and distribution. So maybe that's a way of, maybe that's one way of stimulating innovation. We've seen both ways kind of work, because Linux certainly is a sizable, you know, significant competitive threat to Microsoft in this install base. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, that's debatable, but that's just an alternative view.
So your answer is that the 120 year rule would apply, that if it's published, if the software is created in this way,
and that
120 years later, you don't have to obey the copyright.
The question is, these are individual authors making a contribution, so they would have their own copyright interests.
Right.
So they're not being actively solicited, I don't think. Depends on the scenario. And they're not being paid or engaged in a certain way to produce something for a commissioning party. So where you've got that sort of directive relationship, that's where that work made for hire arrangement gets triggered. But where you've got one or more software developers who are simply contributing their works for the purposes of getting it distributed, they retain their ownership interest as the authors unless it's somehow waived or assigned. Now, this is an interesting point, copyright renewal, and it relates to the long and somewhat tortured history of copyright law in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There were subsequent versions of the copyright law throughout much of the 20th century, and one of the earlier versions of the copyright law, in fact, provided for a copyright term that was in two distinct portions. And to get the benefit of that second term, the copyright owner had to take some affirmative steps to renew their copyright interest. That procedural requirement went away with the enactment of the Copyright Act of 1978. So the mere act of creation allows for the those kinds of terms that we talked about earlier.
Question on corporate. If Disney asks a writing couple to write a musical, is that considered?
That's a work for hire.
That is a work for
hire. Yes, it might not be though.
Well, it might not. I mean,
it doesn't fall under one of the statutory categories in the Copyright Act, even if you have contract.
Yes, that is the answer. It depends on exactly what they've been commissioned to write. What is that going to be part of a compilation, or maybe it's some compilation on the life of. On the, you know, the development of Mickey Mouse as a character, and there may be specific.
Well, in this case, to be simple, The Little Mermaid, or some such.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on the nature of the work. I mean, if it is one of those statutory categories, one of them being the contribution to a collective work, then it could, in fact, be construed as a work made for hire. In the absence of, if it is not that kind of relationship, or if that's not the nature, the subject matter that's being contributed to, contractually, they more likely than not would have set up a framework where there's just an outright assignment of their copyright interest instead of trying to construe it as a work made for hire. It's kind of a fine, it's a legal, it's a definition lawyers will argue over. The end result is the author does not retain ownership of the copyright. That's really the bottom line. So I think we've talked about the five major rights. Now, we did add one variant here that is pertinent to the sound recording business, and that is the right to publicly perform sound recordings via digital audio transmission. But that, in essence, is the fifth copyright. The fifth right under the Copyright Act, the right to publicly perform a copyright at work, in this case a sound recording via digital audio transmission. Now, are there any specific questions on the rights that are granted? or the subject matter of copyright.
I wrote a song once, and later on, somebody said, oh, that reminds me of this, and somebody else said, well, that reminds me of that, and I ended up, you know, going and listening to those tunes, and sure enough, there was a melodic line, you know, in those two or three different tunes that, you know, my tune incorporated. So at what point do I need to worry about, you know, stepping on somebody else's copyright and getting sued?
Well, the point is where there's substantial similarity between the works.
So that's kind of a matter of subjective.
That's a matter of creative arguing in a court of law.
Jury trial.
So, let's talk a little bit about infringement. Ultimately, when you're infringing rights, then there's a violation. Courts try to assess what the scope of your damages are as a copyright owner. And it is actually noteworthy to have some understanding of the differences between the remedies available under patent law and under copyright law. In terms of patent law remedies, there is the potential for compensation in the form of money damages, represented either in the form of the patent owner's lost profits, or reasonable royalty, or an injunction. In the copyright law, it's a little different in that the one form of measurement for the damages is the not the copyright holder's lost profits, but his actual damages and the alleged infringer's profits. So you can dig into that infringer's business and take his profits, even though they don't relate to your lost profits, per se. So there is a potential for a significant recovery, and there is a point I'll mention just a minute why it can be very, very significant. But this isn't the case this is just sort of the basics. There is in the case of a copyright infringement, recovery is available for both the copyright holder's actual damages as well as the alleged infringer's profits. One of the major advantages that are provided to a copyright holder for pursuing a federal copyright registration, and there's absolutely no reason why any copyright owner should not be able to get a federal copyright registration. The cost is virtually de minimis and provides some fantastic benefits. One of those benefits is the opportunity to collect statutory damages. And that's where the actual statute, the law, tells you exactly how much you're entitled to receive for a violation of your rights, rather than having to prove what the scope of your damages are here. And the law says that it's an eye test now. The law says that where there is proof of infringement, as the copyright owner, you're entitled to collect not less than $750 up to $30,000. Now, what's very interesting about this language, and it is definitely in the fine print, you're going to miss it, but it's right here in the second line. That's for all infringements. That means between $750 to $30,000 for each infringing act. Think about it. That's a lot of moolah. And if there's evidence of willful infringement, by statute, the copyright owner is entitled to damages in this amount for each infringing act. Okay? So there's some dollars here. There's some dollars there just for being creative, reducing your work down to some tangible medium of expression, and doing something called registering at the copyright office. You gotta register. So we talked a little about fair use before. Now I want to address your question. 20 years. Why was it bumped? Were you the one who asked the 20-year question?
50 to 70.
50. Yeah, Bob, you were the one. And our friends at Disney are the ones who are responsible for contributing to the extension of the term of protection for copyright. Mickey was about to lose copyright protection.
Mm-hmm.
After all these years, the lobby Congress got
to... But he's still trademarked.
Certainly trademark is available as a source, as an indicator of source. But they, you know, that character has been with, you know, been alive and well in this country in so many different expressive forms for who knows how long, can't even count, that the copyright interest itself is very valuable in addition to the trademark value. So to be specific about your question, Lisa, in terms of fair use, we wanted to know when can one rely upon a fair use exception to copyright infringement liability? And these are some statutory guidelines. It depends on the purpose and character of the use. Is it an academic forum? Are we engaging in the pre-exchange of ideas, really to sort of advance our understanding, or is it for some commercial purpose? What's the nature of the copyright at work? The amount and substantiality of that work, did you take just a portion of it, or was the document as a whole knocked off and put on the web for some commercial purpose? And what's the effect upon the potential market? I told you, once we get out of the realm of academic discussions and the free flow of ideas and the things that the First Amendment was designed to protect, we move into this realm of having an economic impact on the value of the copyrighted work that's actionable. So these are sort of guidelines, but believe me, this was clean, simple, and neat here. In a court of law, it can get very, very difficult.
Was it satire in that as well?
Hmm? Yes.
Satire in there as well?
Satire actually arises more commonly in the trademark context. The classic example of satire was the case involving Larry Flint of Hustler magazine, where he ran that ad, satirical ad about Jerry Falwell being drunk and having sex with his mother in the bathroom and this, that, and the other. So that was intended to protect a parody and satire of a public figure. So in that sense, it tends to apply more commonly in the trademark context.
But you do have some examples that in the music industry, of course, to where Weird Al Yankovic clearly hides right behind his satire or his parody of...
Oh, of Michael Jackson's work?
Everything that he's done.
I think
that at first he wasn't, he just didn't. Uh-huh. And I think that after the fact that he started going to the artists and saying, I'm going to do this, and they by and large agreed because it made their songs a little bit more popular as well.
Well, if he's copying the melody, he has to pay copyright on that. If he's changing the words,
but he's hiding behind satire.
And but he's still using the same melody, and so.
But it's considered it's the First Amendment satire.
Okay.
And he can hide behind it. Do you think, Mike?
I was just thinking about the Two Live Crew case,
right.
Where they took something from Roy Orbison. And the Supreme Court said, well, there's enough satire in that song that, you know, that it was fair to use.
But clearly the public knows that Pretty Woman is a song that Roy Orbison had done, and when Two Live Crew does Pretty Woman with the same tune and some of the same lyrics, the knowledgeable public should be able to distinguish that and clearly recognize that there's social comment going on here as opposed to trying to make money, although they did make some money.
I don't know if we want to wait till a little later on, you know, so you can finish your mm-hmm. presentation in this area, but I do have a question about fair use in the educational realm that, I mean, it happens all the time. Is it okay? Is it not okay? Shall I define it? And you can answer it now or later. There are many orchestras, youth orchestras across the United States that copy the music. Not one copy, not two. If they have five orchestras, then they got a gazillion copies. They don't pay for that. Is that fair use? Is that okay? Is that not okay?
That's sheet music.
Sheet music, of course.
Sheet music for what kind of orchestras?
Any orchestra.
Youth orchestra. Symphony. Non-profit organizations,
youth orchestra. Arguably, there is an educational component, of course.
And chances are the composer is long dead.
Oh yes, it's not about the. It's not even about. Even though that's the very
fair. It might be a copyrighted arrangement.
Oh yes. Well, it's going to be the publisher, or exactly. You know, there's somewhere along the line. There's going to be probably somebody who says, "Wait a minute, I'm selling this stuff, or I own this stuff."
Well, that's my question to me. Is that work being distributed for the purposes of evaluating it in its historical context to understand?
Play the music. Learn the music. Play the music. You know, straightforward.
Educate the kids.
And two, isn't there something where you can destroy it in 6 months?
What?
Isn't there a law or something where you can copy the music but you have to destroy it in 6 months? Is it for educational purposes?
I don't know about this, the necessity to destroy, but if it's a work that, if some portion of the work is used for some educational purpose, that certainly is fair use. In the context of a youth orchestra in the school, arguably, that's fair use. If they're going out giving concerts on the road, charging people a fee, that's a little less of a, there's less of an argument that it's fair use.
You mean if you go to the concert and you must pay for a ticket?
Right.
But it's not necessarily a determinative factor, though, but it's
no.
Certain ways I want to tie it.
But couldn't that just mean that you can take a textbook in Xerox and never buy the textbook?
Well, it's really less of a black and white question. I don't think that we can.
No, I thought fair use was.
Well, in that case, you have an effect upon the potential market. It's the
question. Right, you've got to look at the totality of the circumstances, essentially. You've got to look at all these factors. Yes, okay, you copy the textbook as a whole. Okay, are you going out and creating a secondary market then? Are you putting it in a separate cover, selling it to other students at that school and other schools? Are you simply keeping that copy to yourself? Okay, let's say it is a copyright violation, a copyright infringement. What's the measure of damages? I made a copy, I'm using it to take one course.
$150,000.
They're trying to get around the $150 or $100, whatever it was for the textbook. I just say that that's not
okay. Perfect. Well, we can argue that it's willful copyright infringement. But what is the effect on the market though?
There was
one less book
in Chicago.
Okay, one less book. How much profit is there? How much profit is actually lost by that copyright owner?
$200.
That's not cheap. But there was a case in Chicago of a diocese that would just copy music, you know, willy nilly, mm-hmm. and they got the wrist slapped to the tune of $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
Can't happen.
Right.
So, and the argument is that the two greatest violators in the educational domain of the copyright law are. Within the domain of education and as it were the liturgy of the church. Of sheet music and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is that fair use?
What's the nature of your use?
For a youth orchestra? To learn, kids to learn, play, give concert.
What's the impact on the market for that work?
Some.
Is it significant? Is it significant enough to pursue a claim?
I understand.
The idea is that's the calculus you have to go through. Mm-hmm. That's the calculus any copyright owner has to go through.
How much money does the publisher lose by not selling individual copies of that sheet music to have that played?
And is it worth pursuing it once to make an example of somebody like the music industry is trying to do with pursuing downloading?
And your point that you made earlier about the First Amendment to encourage creativity, I don't think the idea go after a youth orchestra, for God's sake, to discourage them from, there's something wrong with that paradigm. But I mean, just saying that it's an interesting question that I would be willing to guess that at least 9 out of 10 pieces of music that are on the stand are not original, they're copies.
So what if we segue into a peer-to-peer file sharing service where a bunch of students at various universities are exposing each other to new music that they haven't previously heard, which is kind of jumping into this whole master groupster question. And maybe we, I'm going to just jump right into that and say, it's the same question. Is some of these things, what they're doing, is it considered fair use of sorts? And to maybe understand what was going on with some of the Napster Groupster questions, let's jump back to, what are you doing?
Want to talk about Napster or Sean?
I was talking, going backwards. I was going to talk about Sony, which was on the previous slide. And I don't know what I'm going to talk about because I can't see the previous slide. Anyway, the concept here, the case is Sony Corp of America versus Universal Studios, and this all came out of the VCR, or the Betamax. They call this the Betamax case. But essentially, Sony sued Universal City, sort of as it was Universal City that was the copyright owner of all these different television programs that were going out. And they were saying that people use VCRs to record our copyrightable television shows and what have you. And given that, we don't think that should happen. That's just illegal. You're copying our stuff. And again, it raised these questions. Well, what is fair use? I mean, this is just a technological device that will improve our lives. And the concept here is that we want to be able to, what they call, time shift. And we're saying that this television program was played here at 8 p.m., but I'm not home at 8 p.m., and I want to watch it at 10 p.m. when I get home. And I should be able to do that. And clearly, the Supreme Court handed down a ruling that absolutely you should be able to do that. Time shifting is not a violation of copyright law. It is certainly squarely within what we call fair use. Now you've got to talk about groups.
How do we go backwards on this?
Push forward. Push back. Push forward. To go.
Oh, she said the blue button?
The blue button is that slider
thing
that goes away from you and
takes
it back.
Yeah.
Worse than the worst. So, what one of the tenets that came out of this case then is that manufacturers, technology, and devices cannot be held liable for contributory infringement. That perhaps there are people out there using VCRs to do illegal things with copyright. Like, I'm going to make 10 copies of this one. This television show or this movie or what have you, and then sell them on whatever 1983's version of eBay was.
Street corner.
The street corner.
Yeah.
China. So, given that, they're just saying, look, let's not stand in the way of technology. Technology is going to advance, and there's clearly non-infringing uses for these VCRs, as evidenced by the fair use of being able to time shift some of the things that are out there. So let's not hold manufacturers of these devices liable for that sort of thing. Much in the same way that gun manufacturers shouldn't be held liable for people that shoot each other with their guns. But a gun is just a gun. People shoot people. So that brings us to Sean Fanning and his Napster invention, to where I think everybody knows what was going on with this, to say, join my Napster community and upload your songs in MP3 format to my server, and I will make that available to everybody else here. And then that way, as long as you're a friend of mine and you've got connection to my Napster, you can download all of these different MP3 files, and what a wonderful world it will be. So this peer-to-peer file sharing service is for users to share files. But, you know, by and large, we can show that, yeah, well, I have a file of a picture of Earth from NASA that's not copyrightable. And, for that matter, it's a file that I can just share with people. And that's a nice non-infringing use that I can point to. I, the manufacturer of Napster, have provided a great service for people to use for a non-infringing use. If there happen to be a few people out there that are using it to share music that they've illegally copied,
I can't stop that. So, most Napster users illegally shared copyrighted music files probably because Napster advertised. I don't think they use these words, but they you can share copyrighted music files here at Napster. And, well, clearly the files were going to their server. They had a lot of control over that. They were providing lists of songs that you can get, and lots of copyright holders said, wow.
But it was here it was the actual song that was a...
Well, herein lies the question of what really is peer-to-peer. In the Napster case, it was peer-to-server-to-peer. They called all the way peer-to-peer, but clearly they were going through the Napster servers, and Napster had a lot of control over what went on with that. So the Supreme Court in this Napster case, which is about 10 years old all of a sudden, sharply distinguished the Sony case in that Napster maintained a great deal of control of how users participated in the system. I didn't just sell you a VCR and you go off to your home and do things. I am providing an entire network of people along with their files on my server and telling you exactly where to go get them and download them. In fact, I've got great instructions for that, and I advertise it that way. So, Napster was found liable for contributory infringement as the actual share files were stored right there. They were contributing to the peer, and the peer violating copyright law. So, Napster got shut down in a big hurry, and they just clearly lost, and that was a Supreme Court ruling that came down. So, that kind of led to Grokster, and they said, well, what if we just took the peer-to-server-to-peer, the server part, out, and just say, well, I will provide you a whole list of song names that peer A has, along with a whole list of songs that peer B wants, and if some of them happen to match up, well, then they can trade files back and forth. And again, I'm just a manufacturer of technology, and if they want to use this for an infringing purpose, I can't control that. And they thought they were squarely within that. So, again, same sort of thing here. Individual computers, not any Grokster server. There was no actual copy on anything that Grokster had provided. But most brokers usually illegally shared copyrighted files, probably because Grokster advertised, probably not in these words, that you can share copyrighted files here at Grokster. Yeah. And that's what the Supreme Court came down and said, that, okay, we can agree with you that perhaps you didn't contribute exactly to the infringement of this, that everything that you were doing here was you're providing a technology of sorts, but all of the different advertising that you've got going on, all of the different users that use this, I mean, they actually tried to make the argument that they didn't know this was going on, that they didn't realize people used Grokster in this manner. So the court kind of just avoided the whole question, saying we're not going to answer whether or not you actually knew there was direct knowledge, because one, that's a silly argument, and we don't want to get into whether or not companies know that. We should probably look at a few different aspects of what is actually going on behind the technology. So they held that Grokster was inducing copyright infringement, and they borrowed that term a little bit from patent law. So what is inducing versus contributing? Well, it's kind of a semantic thing, but the Supreme Court loves to be semantic at times. So where are we today, then? We've kind of got a number of competing theories of sorts on what to do when we're talking about these different technologies that we're dealing with. The Sony doctrine gave us that somehow there has to be a knowledge requirement for contributory infringement, that Sony stood behind the fact that, look, we don't know what people are doing in their homes with their VCRs. We have no knowledge of that, and it's easy to prove. Napster came along and said, fine, we'll go ahead with that and say that you have to have no knowledge of that, but in the case of Napster, they took no action to prevent or curtail such infringing uses, and one would even say they're really encouraging it and by not providing a service for infringing copyrighted materials. And then the Grokster came along and took that to another level with this inducement, saying that there has to be a clear expression or other affirmative steps taken to foster infringement and imparts liability for inducement of infringement. That is to say that Grokster here, they said they didn't know any about this, or they had made the argument that we weren't suggesting people use this for
illegal activities of sorts, but then they produced really no evidence to back up those statements. And in the end, they shut Brokster down as well. So one of the underlying concepts behind this is that people are still just flat out breaking the law. Whether there's a Brokster or Napster involved, somebody is saying, I want to get a copy of that song and not pay for it. And is that fair use? Typically not. And it kind of comes back to what sorts of arguments can you make as that one kid at school who went ahead and downloaded it one time and just wanted to listen to it to see what it was like. I might want to buy it later. What's wrong with that? Well, that's probably a good question. What is wrong with that? Probably not. When one person does it, nothing. When 10 people do it, a little further on, when hundreds of thousands of people do it, and then decide never to buy it later on, well, then we're into a different question all of a sudden. And where does this go from here? Well, I don't know. It's obvious that the RIAA is going around suing individuals in an effort to, well, they're flat out trying to put a chilling effect out there to say that if you do this, we might sue you. And I had a client approach me saying, I got this letter from a law firm saying they want me to settle for $3,000 and they've got evidence, they're not telling me what it is, but they have evidence that my son has shared illegally these 55 songs. And I kind of looked into it and I suggested to them that they're probably in a good, bad position here, that a good idea to get beyond this is to pay $3,000 and move away. That quite literally they could be on the hook for $150,000. You still have to convince a court of law that that's what they ought to pay.
And that's per each?
Per each one. Right. For each one. So we were looking, I think if you did the quick calculation, somewhere in the neighborhood of $3-5 million. And
letters in general, because you've mentioned letters twice now. And if I'm walking down the street and somebody says, give me $3,000 or something unpleasant will happen to you, that's clearly illegal. Being in the right side of the case, assume that I haven't done anything wrong, and somebody says, give me $3,000 or I'll sue you. I know being sued is an unpleasant experience where I have a chance of losing even though I'm innocent. That's going to cost me lots of time and lots of money. That's not illegal. I was wondering what the distinction is there.
Well, I suppose it's sort of a criminal thing of sorts, that if somebody is saying, give me $3,000 or else, well, what are they implying by or else? Physical harm? I mean, that's threat of assault. Perhaps a silly example.
Right.
But.
So, yeah, writing something with legal action is okay.
Yes.
Okay.
When does it become a
crime? Even though it can be even more unpleasant than a punch to the gut and taking my wallet.
I think it's a punch to the gut.
Yeah.
When does it become extortion? When the underlying reason why you believe you're entitled to the money is a fraud.
The RIAA has actually lost a couple of these cases, I've noticed.
Right. And if
they lost or they dropped them?
It typically comes down to they've lost because they kept them going. What it typically came down to was the person that they had named in the lawsuit, it really wasn't their computer or, you know, grandson came in. It came down to a technicality that they didn't sue the proper person, but somebody else was also shard files that use that computer. By and large, some of those things have come out, and unfortunately for the person that got sued, they had to fight that. And sometimes you have the unpleasant experience, I suppose, of somebody coming down the street and touching you with a letter that says, give me money.
That's a really good question to that. Say, like, you have at home a wireless, open wireless network, so people, you know, in 100 nearby apartments can, in an urban environment, can, like, access your network, and you get a letter. And you know you didn't do it, but somebody must have helped using your network. How would you go about fighting that? And does the fact that that can happen mean that it's no longer safe to kind of expose your network to anybody else, so to speak?
It can happen. I guess there's a couple of nice protections in place of sorts that the RIAA cannot learn who you are through your internet service provider. So assuming somebody is using your account through some kind of internet service provider to do these things, they have been blocked, and they've tried to, they kind of do a John Doe type of lawsuit where they don't know exactly who they're suing. They just know it's user XXXYXX2 on this network here.
Yeah.
And that if the court were allowed that suit to go forward, they could enjoin or force, say, Verizon to disclose who that user is. And they've been blocked at every trial on that, which is a good thing. That we certainly, it almost became statutory of sorts, well, it actually did in the DMCA, saying that we're not going to hold internet service providers liable for this sort of thing. But again, that's more of like a Sony Betamax, that we provide a conduit for doing things. If some of them happen to be illegal, we shouldn't hold the manufacturer.
Because my follow-up is, are these people getting letters? Have they subpoenaed the ISPs to get their names and addresses?
Exactly.
Okay.
And those subpoenas were blocked. But no court has upheld any of those subpoenas yet.
But you need a court or a judge to get a subpoena.
Well, at this point, they don't know who you are, so it's up to the one who's bringing the lawsuit to find out who you are. If they want to spend that money to go to court and try to get you, they can't do that. In a lot of these other cases, they already found out who it was because you had something like a Western Washington University that is cooperating with them to say, when you go to Western Washington University, you're tacitly agreeing that I won't do anything illegal when I use the school's network. And if it might be provided to me at my dorm room, they have the absolute right to disclose who I am if they so choose. And in these cases, they did. They said to the RIAA, we will work with you, and we'll provide you with the names of these people that you request. And so they did, and so they got letters. And that's been happening. I know it happened at Western, it happened at UW, and I think Central was the other choice here in Washington. And roughly 30 students at each of the universities got letters. It was more or less, the letters were an invitation to settle now.
So a subpoena isn't necessarily an end-all for giving up something.
A subpoena for?
Well, he said like they were subpoenaed to give the names of the...
The internet service provider.
Yeah, that's a subpoena is issued by a judge or...
Right.
So don't they acting? You said they was acting blocked, so subpoena even...
Well, they request, to be more clear about the language, they requested a subpoena for that information.
Oh, okay.
And
gotcha.
You
also have to check your user agreement with your ISP and make sure you're not signing over your right that he may in your EULA, depending on who your ISP is, you may say, yes, I give you permission to give my contact info if you are...
Yeah, well, I have nothing to worry about it anyway, but... Yeah.
For example, a different realm in which the ISPs will probably cooperate with the government would be anything terrorist-related. That if they deem your account to be communicating something of national security interest, the ISPs, by and large, have been cooperating to say, well, we will grant you this information on who it is and their billing information or whatever. So, it's a matter of if they choose to cooperate, and most ISPs reserve that right to disclose your information.
So make sure you encrypt everything.
This kind of leads us a little bit into the DMCA, and I thought we'd close with a little discussion on this then. The DMCA is sort of yet another fix to the copyright laws of the nation as we move forward with technology. So this was signed into law in 1998, and it's kind of interesting to note that the Senate unanimously voted to pass it. There was no dissenters in the Senate.
Very good lobby.
Maybe it was very good law. Well, it was well-intentioned law at the time. Certainly thought that it was going to fix a few of these things. What it did was implemented as federal law the adopting of a couple of World Intellectual Property Organization treaties that the U.S. had signed. So we're sort of subject to it, but it hadn't been enacted of sorts, and we brought that into federal statute. Primary goals here were to criminalize the circumvention of digital right management technology, heightened penalties for infringement of copyright over the internet, provide indemnification to the ISPs, and then expand the scope of digital audio transmission rights. And this is the sixth one that was added in to the original five rights that were in 105 17 USC. Lots of criticisms, lots of strengths here. The strengths would include, this is a good one. Everybody clearly wanted to be able to do this, to say that the internet service providers are protected from criminal infringing activities, that they're mere conduits for information to flow. That if two people are trading files back and forth that are copyrighted, it has really nothing to do with the internet service provider themselves. They don't know that it's going on. In fact, they make clear statements to say, we don't want to know what's going on, and that's your right to privacy that we grant you when you come to use our internet service. So there was a lot of talk over this sort of thing, and it all came down to, can we go after the ISPs for, you know, being the master of all this as well, and clearly not. It also provided copyright holders enhanced rights in this internet age of being able to disseminate what they've got in a digital transmission. That all of the other language in the 1976 statute really didn't address anything with regard to a digital dissemination. And I used to say streaming. It's kind of a public performance, but you need some sort of technology underlying in order to publicly perform it. And is it really public when it's going to one single user's computer? It's just all kinds of questions that could have been the subject of lots of litigation, that they just short-circuited all of that in a good manner, in my opinion, by saying, well, look, let's just call it out specifically for what it is. So any kind of digital transmission is one of the reserved rights of a copyright holder. So certain technology companies gain some power to protect their technology, and I can think of Apple being a very good one, that clearly when they come out with their iPod and they come out with their M4P standard for taking a WAV file into some other format, you're not allowed to go figure out what that is. And circumventing that technology is criminalized by the DMCA. So lots of different companies that said, well, we're investing a lot of time and energy and effort and money into providing technology to the public so that they can usefully purchase and use some of this copyrighted material. We don't want that just simply circumvented, and then we lose all of our time and interest in that investment. So clearly these companies saw this as a strength. It depends on which company you were, though. Because there's other companies that, well, certainly wanted to create similar technologies and at least be allowed to compete with the likes of Apple. And with the way that the law was set up with regard to the DMCA, you're not allowed to really even find out what they're doing or how you might be able to do it better, because that would be perhaps considered a circumvention of the digital right management software of sorts. And this had a very chilling effect that... And that was a big, strong argument. I think it's a very good argument to say, what's more important here is that we clearly want to be able to protect the underlying copyrights, but at the same time, we also want to allow the free flow of ideas in all realms, including the technology side of things, in an effort to say, perhaps there's a better way to do this. And circumvention is criminalized now, it's a tough thing.
I thought the DRM was mandated by the content holders, not by the technology providers. You know, like cracking the DVD code, the CCS, whatever it was. You know, Apple was delighted when people cracked it because they bought bigger hard drives and new computers to play with their new movie libraries. So Apple could care less whether the DRM was cracked. Hollywood, on the other hand, had major issues with it. So I thought it came from
it comes right back to, it depends on which company you are. That if you're the company that benefits from DRM, will you like this? If you're a company that wants, that has a tough time competing or would benefit from people cracking DRM, you don't like this.
The circumvention can be posted anonymously on the internet. Now then, finally everybody could have it. Could be anonymous.
Yeah. And you see lots of that. I mean, how many different times has Apple updated what their algorithm is in an effort to get past the people that have cracked it in the first place and put the different cracks out on their web? Probably about 6 or 7 or 8 times now. Another criticism is it's just too easy to force websites to remove potential infringing material. That we have all of these different fair use questions that might come into the fray, yet with the takedown notice procedure provided by the DRM or the DMCA, again, another chilling effect here of it's just far easier to not have to fight that fight. That if you've got, you're a one-off website providing this, that, and those, and all of a sudden you get hit with a real quick, I sent an email out to 57 different websites today that said you gotta stop, and here's the form letter. It's just easy to throw that out there, and all of a sudden all these probably fair uses are just taken down because people get scared. They're chilled into not exercising their full fair use of some of these copyrighted materials.
Fine if your anti-spam filter doesn't dump it.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I didn't get your email. The DMCA also provided legal means, for the most part, to create these closed types of platforms. That I'm Apple, I'm the industry leader, I can create this little closed thing and you can't crack it. And you're not going to be allowed to do so because I have statutory criminal protection against that. And, well, where does this all lead to? Don't know. We're kind of into an age here where we're learning more about how we're going to use the different technologies to disseminate information, whether in a good way or a bad way. And we're starting to see some cases follow through to where we can at least point to them and say, here's some bright line rules that have been established when the circumstances are like this. An interesting one that we're going to see is going to be what happens with the Viacom versus Google, which is CBS suing YouTube over any number of things that are showing up on YouTube. That's more like a Napster-Grokster type of thing, but Google has a heck of a lot of evidence up to suggest that they're trying to stop that, or they're suggesting that people shouldn't use it that way, and they're doing all of the things that they said in Grokster didn't do. So, if Google, puts up all of those different statements and tells everybody that's using it, you have to agree not to do these things, and Google is essentially doing everything it possibly can to prevent this sort of thing from going on, yet it still does, can we possibly hold Google liable for that anyway? I guess we'll find out here in 3 to 5 years. And as some of these come up, and there's other... there's another case that's up right now with Google that got sued by a company called Perfect 10 that owns the rights to various centerfolds of sorts. And Google's search engine through images, you could do a search on the names of those centerfolds and you get a little thumbnail of that. And then you could click through to Perfect 10's website and pay $5 a month or whatever to be able to view those. They sued Google over the fact that there's a little thumbnail showing up there that... That's a small copyright infringement right there, albeit small, still is. Exact copy of the image that was once there. Google has won that case, saying that we're just presenting people with information, and the information happens to be visual. And that came down on the side of fair use.
Has there already been some legislative tinkering with the DMCA since it was passed in its original form? Or do we have to wait for these lawsuits to sort of refine it one by one?
I think, I'm not sure if it's been, maybe in small sorts of ways it has been tinkered with.
Well, I wonder if Congress can do every year or 3 years, they have a thing where they gets a certain set of exceptions to the DMCA.
That's what it is.
And one of them was that you could, it was illegal to crack the DRM on your cell phone so you could switch carriers.
Mm.
You know, things like that. But they're very minor so far. There's been nothing major to make any real significant change. They've just gone after the more egregious examples.
So it's working its way through the courts right now is what it's doing.
Yeah, we're letting big boys figure out what to do.
Yeah. I know there's been a bill proposed a couple of times that hasn't gotten very far, trying to make fair use a concept that applies to the anti-circumvention rules. Right now, even if you're circumventing DRM to do what would be a fair use under copyright infringement law, it's still a violation of the circumvention. They're trying to get of the circumvention rules. They're trying to pass the bill saying, well, if you're circumventing the DRM to make a fair use, then it's okay. But
I think I've seen that bill. It's on Pat Leahy's desk if you want to send Senator Leahy from Delaware an email. Until he decides to bring it up, it's on his desk of sorts. I think that brings us to our fascinating question and answer session that often begin with, so I have a friend who.
Where did you get the name Axios?
Yeah, well, this came from, it was all one partner's creation of sorts. He spent a lot of time on it, and I think in the end the rest of us just said, that good. But I think that a lot of it came from, it's a word that starts with A, and then it's listing of something, well, there's at least that advantage. Axios generates questions of like, well, what does that word mean of sorts? It's a Latin root for the state of being axiomatic. That is to say that this argument is worthy and that it's an axiomatic argument that carries the day. So we are a law firm of nerds with Latin names. That is worthy. Good questions throughout, though. Go ahead, Rick.
Let's see, the international patent, the international IP,
Intellectual Property Organization?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are they the reason that certain products, notably software, can't be exported or shipped even to certain other countries, for instance, the Middle East?
No.
Okay.
No, it depends on the nature of the. A couple of things are implicated by your question. There is an arm of the United States government, the Export Administration, that has a committee there's an arm that monitors technologies that are being exported that may have dual civilian and military uses. And those technologies, regardless of how much a private sector company wants to export it, will not be granted a license to export. So they will trump the right of any IP holder to export that technology.
Like encryption.
Like encryption, yes. And certain munitions technologies, nuclear technology for that. Militarily critical technologies do not get exported.
Certain high-speed processes used to be could export.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
I have a really basic question. I have 70 CDs worth of original music that I want to copyright, you know, legally with the government, and I don't want to spend $3,500 or $4,000 of them all in separate. Can I just send in like one DVD with 10,000 songs on it and copyright all that, and then just later on I want to, you know, distribute it or do whatever, I can take each song out separately and copyright each.
Isn't that a collection?
You can copyright it as a collective work, but in order to invoke statutory damages, which is the good reason why you want to file a copyright in the first place, somebody would have to, for the most part, infringe the compilation.
Right.
The whole thing. Every single one.
Mm.
you pull one song out of there, they don't violate your registered copyright. They do violate a copyright, but then you're in the realm of saying, I need to prove what those damages are, and that's less desirable than just saying that big $150,000 is what I think I'm deserving.
So you're saying you need to then copyright every single individual song?
In order to realize the benefits of the statutory damages.
I'll go bankrupt before I publish anything.
Pick a good one.
You might have to pick and choose one or two that are looking good.
The recording copyright, seed copyright symbols, you could just distinguish those. They're half a feature of function.
Circle C simply says it's copyright, and anything we do, the copyright exists as soon as it's fixed in tangible medium. So to the extent we're being recorded here tonight, we do have a copyright in what we've been talking about. We're choosing not to really enforce that. We're kind of
getting
a class permission of doing so. Yeah, this whole thing is owned by somebody, arguably us.
Well, you said under your copyright, but they said it's under their copyright.
Sort of, if you want to get to that technical level, but yes. But the long and short of it is the circle C disseminates the fact that there's copywritten material here.
And you don't even need that anymore, do you?
No,
you don't need to mark your work. That's correct about the Berne Convention. But to be just a little more technically correct, the circle C implies that there is a federal copyright registration.
I.e. Library of Congress? Or?
Yeah.
I thought that was a circle R, or are they both denoting of a federal?
Actually, you're right, the circle R.
If you go to circle R, circle R designates that you registered with the U.S. federal government. Circle C just sort of designates
that R is registered as the owner to assert your own copyright interest, but there is no really a requirement to mark it, but it is a very good practice to mark your own copyright rights.
And then the circle P?
Phone no record.
I've never seen circle P.
Circle P is visual. Circle P is for audible.
Yeah.
There's a legal term called phono record, which means an audible, something that you don't see with your eyes, you hear with your ears, and I think it refers to that.
That's P.
It's an old term.
Phono record. Phono record is the equivalent of a copy, except it's the tangible medium that audible sound effects in.
On our CDs, we have the triple C, triple E, Grand Star. So we get both. Because there's two types of copyright.
One might think of having a
photograph record.
Does anybody know why you see all rights reserved?
Because there's many different kinds of rights. And
that's a problem.
And it's up to you, the owner, which rights you intend to relinquish or assign?
Yes and no. Actually, okay. There's one block of countries that did not actually join with a major international treaty, so there's an entirely different copyright treaty, the Universal Copyright Convention, which requires that you mark your goods with those words to qualify for protection in that region. The South American countries, the Universal Copyright Convention. So, what you see on movies, films, is both the copyright symbol and all rights reserved. The name of the author, copyright symbol, year of copyright, and all rights reserved.
And take that, circle P knowers.
Do you have to disclose the copyright holder's name also in that notice?
The ownership, that's correct. To properly mark it. Again, there is no obligation or requirement to mark your work, but if you do, to maximize protection, you should use that format: author, symbol, year.
The first year it was published, I believe.
The year of creation.
Oh, I thought it was the year.
The year the work is created.
Because for my compilation, for instance, it covers, right? So we have a triple C, triple P, even though we don't have a copyright in the underlying composition, but we do have a copyright in masters that are on that disc, for instance. So our triple C brand new record is for those masters specifically. And then we also give the attribution of the underlying
copyright and who their BMI and ASCAP affiliations are and who to pay for that kind of thing. So it's a big block of fine print. But we still hold the copyright certificate and triple P for the package, the phone record. It's basically, the cover art is under the triple P. And that is a triple P, it's self-copyrighted.
Well, that is the absolute nth degree way to do it.
We wanted to do that, to spend
market talking to make sure that there's that all interests are properly identified and allocated.
So we have a client who wrote songs between somewhere in the 1980s up to very recently, who's going to release a CD Christmas or thereafter. Mm-hmm. The copyright would apply from when? Or would the copyright be CD related?
Well, let's back up for a minute. You asked a couple of things, but you said we have a client. What kind of company do you?
We're recording the CD. We have an audio video studio.
Okay, so was this a client you had some written agreement with that set forth the nature of the relationship?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. What kind of agreement? I'm
trying to get into the work made for hire arrangement or.
So it's not his copyright, it's the client's
copyright. It's not, I'm not a part of that copyright of the song itself.
Yeah.
The application, my question applies to how long are those songs for that client? How long does from whence does the copyright begin?
Yeah, from date of creation, then to the life of the author, plus that many.
Oh, so that's it. It's not applying to Library of Congress or anything.
As soon as it was fixed in a tangible medium.
Right.
Okay. And the CD, that's separate.
Right. If you've got it, it lives on a hard drive or even analog tape for that matter somewhere.
But you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're two different. Right.
They're really two different things. Once the key is creation of the work and then fixation of that work in some tangible medium. So that really is the technical instinct when a copyright exists.
The creation, that you wrote the songs from the 80s until recently,
correct.
But you never recorded them.
Didn't record them.
And this is the first time. The first time they've ever been fixed is this recording, both recording the songs and in the sound recording.
If we are splitting hairs like that, then the date that the sound recording is actually recorded, that might be a separate date from the date on which the work itself was created.
Usually is. But this could also be the nth time that work is recorded, right? And so each instance of recording carries its own copyright.
Yeah.
In a sense, in the expression of that new one, that perhaps this new one had a new.
The performance is copyrighted, but the song is copyrighted with a different one. They're two separate copyrights.
So you should have somebody say copyright blah 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 in between each track. Ruin the whole song.
I basically just want to take 25 years of his stuff and put it in the government's vault and say, hey, I wrote this stuff 25 years ago, so that if I start sharing CAN CDs to somebody, and they end up wanting to steal it or something, they say, well, I wrote it. I just want something, I just want to be able to turn it up.
You can just publish it, right?
I don't want to spend $10,000 just to send in 1,000 songs.
Publish it. You can make some money off at the same time. Right?
Well,
doesn't that help also?
But wait, why copyrighted it if it's not published?
So when it is published, that's also copyrighted.
If I share it with somebody and then 5 years from now they steal something I wrote 20 years ago, and I don't have any proof that I wrote it because I never sent anything with copyright on it.
Right. What you're talking about is being able to have definitive proof that you did this once before. They did.
You didn't touch on it.
That's all I want to be able to do at the moment. So can I just turn in a DVD with 1,000 songs on it? The date next to each song or something?
That'll work for proof.
Yeah.
They won't trigger some of the other things that you'd like, but at least it gives you prima facie proof that this was created by you before.
Doesn't publishing?
Publishing does the same thing.
But automatic copyright.
Yeah, absolutely. Automatic copyright.
It's also proof.
What he's got copyrights. Everything that you've got has a copyright because it's been recorded on something.
Right.
So, how do you prove it, and what is publishing? Put it somewhere, put it on the internet, send it to BMI?
Send it to, yeah.
What is publishing? Not what is publishing as a business, but can you just define the legal term publishing?
There you go.
Or at what point is a piece of art legally public?
Good question.
Say. When it's available to the public?
I think that the legal definition is when it's available to the average public.
Has to be greater than a limited group.
Yep.
Right.
So putting it on the web would publish it.
Yep.
Yes.
So somebody's playing a concert. They've never recorded anything. They've never written anything down. They don't know how to write notes. They're the Beatles. You know, but they haven't recorded anything yet. They're going out there playing, you know, in public. And before they record anything, somebody goes, this band isn't fine. I'm going to take their songs and publish them myself. They haven't written literally anything in fixed form. They haven't recorded anything in fixed form, but they obviously composed these songs 3 years before, and somebody comes along 3 years later and says, mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to publish this music, and ha ha ha, I'm you know. But everybody heard it, you know, or who, maybe they only played for a private gig, or maybe they played it live, I don't know. But
that's the legal definition of it, yes.
It has to be in fixed form.
Fixed form.
Fixed form.
There is no copyright.
It's a cassette. You know, just have someone running a cassette while they're playing it, that's it.
Yep.
Right. It doesn't have to be...
There exists no copyright whatsoever without a fixed form.
Of course, I could come by with a strong magnet.
But it was fixed at one point.
It was fixed. That was broken. That's right. What do you mean for what belongs to them?
Does it? Well, what does belong to them? I mean, we're talking about a very specific... intangible right. And the very definition of it as accepted throughout the world is an original expression. There's no question that's an original expression, but it has to be fixed in a tangible medium. And if you're just performing it, there's nothing there.
It's a tree falling in the forest. With no
kind of sort of that, yeah.
Right.
So, to use a different example, we're being recorded on the audio. So if I was to kind of do a little jig,
we get a bigger hand.
I can't copyright that.
That's a curve.
Because it hasn't been fixed in a tangible medium of expression. If you're videotaping, then I've got something, but I don't.
I'd say make bunches of copies and your name on it and the C with the circle on it. And
put it on.
Put as many of them out there as you can.
Do you have a website?
Put it on, you know, offer them on eBay. You know,
hey,
I'll buy one.
Put it on the website
while you're at it.
Then it's published. Put it on the website.
And
it's published.
Sure. On that homepage.
Have Steve master it,
or Brent here, yeah. Or, you know, or... So if I wrote it 25 years ago, do I put tomorrow's date on it if I put it on the internet?
When did you record it? When did you fix it in a tangible medium?
If I can't remember, it was between 81 and 85.
Make up a date. Nobody else will know.
Yeah, I mean...
You know, 1,000 songs you don't remember, 10,000...
Right. It comes down to at least, maybe at least as early as kind of thing, or...
And you can put a range too, so C 1981 to 2007.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. And then if somebody wants to get technical with you, then you can get technical with them. But
that's what that is. If you're going to put it on the website, I just put it on your first page, C, yeah. Range, your name, all rights reserved, all that stuff at the bottom, and then it just covers your website.
And if somebody comes back later on and says, well, where's your fixed form for 1981 to 83? Oh, well, I don't actually have a recording of that. And then that's just when I composed it. I didn't record it until 2007.
And the copyright from the composition, right?
Creation, right?
Well, you wrote it down, didn't you?
Well,
when you wrote a song, didn't you write down the lyrics?
Over half of it's instrumental, so...
So how do you write it recorded way back then? It's kind of the question, how do you prove that that was actually recorded then, or if you don't have it any longer?
Exactly.
I don't know what the question
for it. If someone that did it in 1987 and comes back and says, how can you prove that you wrote this in 1983? That's not the only place where it actually comes up as a problem.
Right.
Is if they find it on the website and say, wait a second, I have a recording here in 1987 of this that I did, and so you obviously stole from me unless you can prove the prior art of the 1983 recording. But that's still unlikely.
Yeah, it's pretty far fetched.
Good, so you know, yeah, throw one away.
Or what on the off chance that this other person actually just came up with exactly what you did?
Yeah, possible.
Kind of like George Harrison did with the the Shangri-Las.
Yep.
My Sweet Lord.
Yep.
But he claims I've never heard that other song. I came up with this other one myself. Court
let
said,
it be worse.
Court said no, but. In that case, they said it's just so substantially similar, there had to be... They actually used the word that there was a subconscious copying going on.
Yeah.
So George Harrison must have heard the other one.
So will I get in trouble if I know that I composed the song in 1980, but I never recorded it until 87 or 90 or something? Will I get in trouble if I don't have, if I'm saying that? Because I know maybe when I composed it, but I never wrote it down or recorded it.
But you get in trouble for what? To the best of your knowledge.
It's not a fixed form.
It has to be a fixed form in order for a copyright to attach. If you just leave it as copyright, you say, I don't know the year.
I have to put it on the date 2007.
If you wrote it
down.
Composed it in the 80s.
Yeah. Sorry. No, it's like him dancing on the stage, I think. That clears up some stuff.
For me. At my mother's next birthday, will I get in trouble if I sing Happy Birthday?
Legally.
How many people are going to be there?
Is this other performance?
Where are you going to be? Here's a question. Where are you going to be at home? Are you going to be at the local eatery?
I don't know.
Because if you're at, let's say you're right here, I'm pretty sure that this place has some kind of deal going with BMI or ASCAP. Presumably, Happy Birthday is covered under one of those two performing rights societies, to where they've got a blanket license for all of that. And if you happen to sing Happy Birthday here, the blanket license for the venue has covered your public performance of that.
However, what if in the unlikely possibility were either my home or hers, then does that change things?
That's fair.
Not a public performance.
You could be approached by the Mr. ASCAP or BMI walking down the street who happens to hear Happy Birthday and walks in and I see that you're performing one of our songs publicly without a blanket license of any kind. So we need you to sign this because we think you're going to continue to do this or such. And then you just laugh at them and say, get out of here.
There is one point to take into consideration. If you take the Happy Birthday song in particular, it's more likely than not the chance that it's already in the public domain.
Happy Birthday is actually still covered.
I heard that Happy Birthday actually started as good morning to you instead of Happy Birthday to you. Is that, everybody ever heard that?
Yeah, could be.
Oh. If that was true, then they stole and they're. Happy birthday, lady!
Somebody,
happy birthday, lady!
The copyright.
The thing about it though is that the lyrics are hers and the rhythm, dun da dun. Therefore, all the published versions I've seen, at least I'm referring now because I also teach from students, you never see that dotted rhythm. You see bum bum. You see a change.
Interesting.
Yeah. And my understanding is that, yes, it is under copyright even at this point in time. It is the longest copywritten thing,
That's another fun, there's no such word as copywritten.
Yes.
Well, what did I say? Copywritten?
Copywritten. It's copyrighted.
Excuse me.
Or copy protected.
It's not written.
Still this existing copyright?
I'm sorry?
Can we still use the old mail it to yourself technique?
Do you think it's okay?
Again, it comes down to what does that do for you? It establishes the fact that you can prove that a point in time you did create this, but it's so very easy to prove that in any other way, especially in, let's say, a digital age when the computer file has a date stamp.
But then you can create that in a second.
That sort of thing more or less comes down to how are you going to use it and who do you need to convince, and more likely it's in a court of law and you're convincing a judge or a jury to trust you that I mailed it to myself and I didn't tamper with it, or just simply say, look, I created it back then.
Well, you'd have to open it right in front of everybody. You wouldn't be able to open it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of that one of those...
You know, prove that you didn't open it and then
reveal it. Hail the source.
You down the mail.
The last question, it might sound silly, but if, for instance, I'm in a performing organization and we're playing for somebody's birthday and say, would you play the Happy Birthday song? Are we supposed to actually get the okay?
Well,
charge them extra money.
I would say
it's preposterous and then.
Yeah. Well, more often than not, you're probably going to be at some public venue that may have already paid that blanket license for you.
I would turn myself in.
The one time public performance, there have been different scenarios of I'm driving down the street with my radio up loud, and in the street there's a public performance of Tupac Shakur's song, and am I violating something there because that guy can hear it too? Or how about when my cell phone rings and I've got a Britney Spears song in place? I don't.
SPL meter and a reading 905 dB, you know, at 50 feet or something.
It's the kind of technical legality stuff that is fun to talk about here, but just never comes up. It's just not going to.
Yeah, how many dB SPL is a public?
And when it comes down to it, you would argue those four points under the fair use statute to say, is it, how much is it, how does it affect the market, what is the underlying purpose? And it all comes back down to that balancing act of those four statutorily created factors.
Is it legitimate for me to understand that fair use thing is so dodgy that it's a little tough to say yes, no, maybe, or whatever on it?
Yeah. At the same time, you know, you're one-off, I played Happy Birthday once, this one time. Those sorts of things almost always come down to it just didn't impact the market at all, and it was such a one-time thing where the underlying purpose was just, more often than not, those are just strong, solid arguments to make.
It's in the noise. So you're trying to figure out what comes above the noise with this audience, you know, because the noise is pretty important.
Right.
So.
Well, I mean, whether it's Happy Birthday or whether or not it's somebody copying music and it's an organization playing it, or, you know, this kind of stuff.
Right. Tough question.
Record the song and put it up free on the internet.
Yeah, see what happens.
This is good. Thank you.
Yeah. It's late. So I think, thanks for all the questions. Thanks for having us here. We certainly appreciate the opportunity to come and entertain questions.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.